Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. We always start out with some debt-related news and facts for the week, and this week it's actually an interview between Michael Moore and Elizabeth Warren at the HuffingtonPost.com, which I'm sure you will find very interesting.
The very, very smart people who run Wall Street and run these financial institutions, they knew exactly where the car they were in was going, right toward the cliff, and figured out how to still live while taking the car over the cliff.
Yeah, that's the most astonishing part of this whole wreck now, is that the very people who drove the car over the cliff have been instrumental in shaping how the American taxpayer was supposed to save it and reconstruct it. And that's really amazing. In the past, when you drove the car over the cliff, you lost your job. I was talking to someone who spent many years as a prosecutor, and he said, you know, when that much money disappears, it's usually because somebody broke some laws somewhere. But if we don't look, if we don't ask, if we don't uncover it and make it all public, we'll never find out.
Where is the criminal investigation that needs to happen here?
I haven't seen it. Yeah. I just haven't seen it at all. What the government didn't do is it didn't turn around and say, you lost how much money, and you wiped out how many pensions, and you wiped out how many jobs? I want to know who did what, whether or not any laws were violated, where the gaps are in the system that would permit this to happen. I want to hold somebody responsible. Responsibility is not just about blame. Responsibility is about making sure we fix this and it will not happen again. But it starts with the notion that that's the right question to ask, rather than what can I give you now to make it all better.
During the 90s, corporate America did very well. You would think at the end of that decade, they would have the attitude of, geez, we've done really well. This is great. You know, let's create a better country. Let's help, you know, let's maybe there's something we can give back. Instead, it seems like they went looking for where's the next source of revenue, because we need to make even more. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, there's all these Americans that own their homes. Let's get them to refinance. Let's get them into these adjustable rate mortgages to where they may not be able to pay it back. And we may be able to get all this equity in our hands, taking it from their hands.
It's a big part of what happened. And then just layer on top of that, can we sell them more credit cards that are loaded with tricks and traps and ways that you can squeeze out $35 here and $49 there from people who have pretty modest means? Financial products, and they are products, they're products just like toasters, are sold today with the most dangerous features embedded in them because that's what drives profitability. What's astonishing is that we let this happen. You know, you can't buy a toaster in America that has a 1 in 5 chance of exploding, but you can buy a mortgage that has a 1 in 5 chance of exploding, and they don't even have to tell you about it. We don't hand people a wiring diagram with a toaster and say, you figure it out. But you sit down to do a mortgage closing, And it's sign here, sign here, sign here, sign here, sign here for 141 pages. And boy, if it turns out back on page 89 that they really socked it to you, then you just been socked to. We have consumer protection for everything you touch, taste, smell, feel. This glass tabletop, the jacket you're wearing, your glasses, my lipstick. But there's no equivalent for credit cards, for mortgages. There's nothing. I'm old enough that I remember a credit card I could understand. According to the Wall Street Journal, in 1980, the typical credit card agreement was about a page and a half long. Today, it's more than 30 pages long of incomprehensible text. My own credit card, I looked to see what the interest rate was they were going to charge me. You ready for this? I counted 47 lines of text that included LIBOR and rediscount and right until you get down to the last line. And the last line says, notwithstanding the foregoing, the company reserves the right to charge any amount at any time for any reason. That's a standard term in a credit card now. We'll charge you what we want to charge you, when we want to charge you, and you're legally obligated to pay it. You know, it's not just that poor people have been fooled. Everybody's been fooled in this game. And right now, the legal system is on the side of the banks. The legal system says, yep, there it is. Page 32 on that particular one, 47 lines, look at the bottom. I teach contract law at Harvard Law School, and I can't understand my own credit card.
You're kidding.
No, I am not kidding you. We're all at risk that a toaster could blow up, whether you're rich or whether you're poor. But a credit card blowing up, it can happen to any of us. But if you're rich enough, it won't hurt so much. If you're poor, it can wreck your whole life. I grew up poor in Oklahoma, and I got a lot of family who really worked hard. They played by the rules. They did their best. And they got sucked in like lots of other people on this. The only reason I'm here in Washington is to try to let those people have a seat at the table, just for a minute. They didn't have a seat at the table while we built this problem, while we kept our ears covered and let these banks go off and create this monster. And now, here we are, letting many of those same people construct what they say will be the solution. If the people who were directly affected, the people whose lives have been wrecked by this, are not represented at the table, we won't get the right solutions. In fact, what we'll go back to is a world that just makes this worse. Yeah, we'll patch this one together. And then in 10 years, it crashes again, and it crashes again, and it crashes again. I wish I could say something shorter and better and more direct about it. But that really is my job. My job is to be here, for the people who just don't get a voice in this game. Right. They've been shut out now for 30 years in this.
Right.
It's to say no more.
And this is what I've just come to believe, is that capitalism in and of itself, at least the capitalism we know now, it's immoral, it's not democratic, and worst of all, it doesn't work. And they've proven it doesn't work.
But we made up these rules. And the rules are of men, of people. We pick what the rules are. The rules have not been written for ordinary families, for the people who actually do the work. We have to rewrite those rules.
If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. You have just been listening to an exclusive interview between Michael Moore and Professor Elizabeth Warren in Washington, D.C., and posted on the HuffingtonPost.com. Continuing with the second segment of the show, we go into more educational points to help you directly with your debt issues. And I've been using the Two Income Trap by Professor Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi as the background text for the last few shows and continuing into the future, looking specifically at why middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke and what kind of solutions we can have to deal with that. Please note that the thoughts, ideas, and example used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are really two of America's leading champions for debtors. I do highly recommend that you read their books, The Two Income Trap and All You're Worth. And you can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look under the Life and Debt section, and you can listen to any, if not all, of the shows that we have made in the past, which build on really invaluable points to set up your financial situation to cope with debt, to avoid it, to get rid of it, and to have a budget and a future that is financially sound. The main point that I ended with last week is the discussion of consumption, and particularly in America, what we would conceive of as overconsumption and what many people actually declare to be an overconsumption myth. During the past generation, this thought has swept through America, and Professor Warren feels it is a myth, that the overconsumption myth tells a tale to explain a really confusing world. Why are so many Americans in financial trouble? Why are credit card debts up and savings down? And why are millions of mothers heading into the labor force and working overtime? She says that the myth is so deeply embedded in our collective understanding that it resists even the basic kind of questionings. Families have spent too much money buying things they don't need. The conclusion is Americans have a character flaw, perhaps a new one, the urge to splurge, and it is driving them to spend and spend like we've never done before. There's been an attempt to try to understand why Americans supposedly have this drive. There's a book called Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic by John DeGraff, in which he says it's as if we Americans, despite our intentions, suffer from some kind of willpower deficiency syndrome, a breakdown in affluenza immunity. Another scholar, economist Juliet Skaar, blames the new consumerism as the basis for the problem. She points to mass overspending within the middle class, in which large numbers of Americans spend more than they say they would like to, and more than they have. That they spend more than they realize they are spending, and more than is fiscally prudent. So that's economist Juliet Skaar. Much of it is then essentially combined, and many of the maladies are explained away by the overconsumption myth. For example, why are Americans in debt? One sociologist, Robert Frank, claims that America's newfound luxury fever forces middle-class families to finance their consumption increases largely by reduced savings and increased debt. Another example that is used is, why are schools failing and streets unsafe? Again, Juliet Skaar cites competitive spending as a major contributor to the deterioration of public goods, such as education, social services, public safety, recreation, and culture. And then for many people, the question is raised, why are Americans unhappy? The book Affluenza sums it up. It says, the dogged pursuit for more. That's what accounts for Americans' overload, debt, anxiety, and waste. So, as Professor Warren points out, everywhere we turn, It really does seem that overconsumption is tearing at the very basic fabric of American society. So we think back in our own lives and we say, well, maybe this is true. Maybe there is some overconsumption that my family is doing, that I'm doing, and that's why I may be in some financial distress. In short, the overconsumption myth rests on the premise that families spend their money on things they don't really need. Now, are we doing that? Do you do that? Think about that. But then also think about what's not in overconsumption. It's not about medical care or basic housing. It is, in the words, again, of Juliet Skaar, about designer clothes, microwave, restaurant meals, home and automobile quality, and in her quote, Michael Jordan's ubiquitous athletic shoes, about which children and adults both display near obsession. This is going back some years, but is this continuing to be true with other professional athletes or our rich and famous heroes
that we try to pattern our life on?
Overconsumption, though, is not about buying a few goodies with extra income. It's about going very deep into debt to finance consumer purchases that sensible people basically could and should do without. Now, the whole beauty of this theory is that the overconsumption myth squares neatly with our own
intuition.
Just go to the mall, which is packed with shoppers. How many catalogs do you receive each day?
And of course, those catalogs are filled with outrageously expensive gadgets. And then there's those power tools that are gathering dust in the garage or basement, or those seasonal fashion articles that hang in the back of the closet, all leading to the same conclusion, which really seems indisputable. There's an urge to splurge, which is driving folks into economic ruin. So that's the intuition, and there are some data anecdotally to support that kind of conclusion. But is it true? Intuitions and anecdotes are not substitutes for hard data. So Professor Warren searched deep into the recesses of federal archives, where she found detailed information on America's spending patterns since the early 1970s, and carefully sorted by spending categories and family size. If families really are blowing their paychecks on designer clothes, restaurant meals, etc., then the expenditure data should show that today's families are spending more on these frivolous items than ever before. And of course, the data had to be adjusted for the effects of inflation when the study was done. Curiously enough, what Professor Warren discovered was that the numbers pointed in a very different direction, demonstrating that the overconsumption explanation, as she puts it, is just a myth. Professor Warren gives an example. She says, consider clothing. When she wrote the book, The Two-Income Trap, Newsweek had recently run a multi-page cover story about Americans drowning in debt. It stated that the reason for widespread financial distress and high bankruptcy rates was frivolous shopping as a part of the problem, because many debtors blame their woes squarely on designer purchases. And that does sound reasonable. After all, when you go to the mall and you go into the hot stores, they're so crowded with shoppers you can barely find an empty fitting room. And until very recently, designer shops were raking in profits selling things like underwear or sunglasses. And having a 14-year-old daughter, I know that children's clothes now carry hip brand names, and my grandsons have brand names on their t-shirts and sleepers. Again, we think we have more data. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Yet, when it was all added up, including all of these designer items, according to the data that Professor Warren found, the average family of four today spends 21% less, of course, with inflation adjustment, on clothing than a similar family did in the early 1970s. How can this be? When it was analyzed, what Professor Warren came up with was that families don't spend money on certain things anymore. What we see now are shifts in things like business casual sweeping the nation, where expensive suits, ties, and pantyhose have been replaced by cotton trousers and knit tops, as one example. Also, there are new fabrics, new technology, and cheap labor have lowered prices. We also have some major discounters now, like Target. There was Marshall's and Walmart popping up across the country, providing reasonable, low-cost clothes for today's families. And when you put it all together, the differences do add up. Believe it or not, in 1973, Sunday dresses, wool jackets, and the other clothes for a family of four claimed nearly $750 more, of course, inflation adjusted.
That is
$750 more a year from the family budget than all the name brand sneakers and hip kind of t-shirts and sweatshirts and clothes
that today's families are buying.
Then we think, well, maybe it's not the clothes. We're not blowing our paychecks on clothes. We must be overspending money on food. And being a family that uses organic foods, I can jump on this bandwagon myself.
Also,
in almost every food store, we have now designer brands of food that are on the shelves with far more prepared foods, high-end ice creams, exotic juices. Think about it. There are a lot of items there that are available. Just think about buying water and the bottles of water, not to mention the exotic water. I have an 85-year-old Italian immigrant uncle in New York who has never taken water from a plastic bottle, refuses to allow it in his house, and is shocked by the whole concept. And yet, I have another daughter who lives in California, and she and her family drink bottled water exclusively. They never drink from any tap. And this, of course, we see around us as a health issue for many people in many communities. And besides that, with two people at work, who even cooks at home anymore? Both mom and dad are there at work. Americans are eating out or ordering in more than ever before. As the quote from Affluenza, the book, states, city streets and even suburban malls sport a United Nations of restaurants. Eating out used to be a special occasion. Now we spend more money on restaurant food than on the food we cook ourselves. So these examples are correct, but only to a certain point. The average family of four, for example, spends more at restaurants than it used to, but it spends less at the grocery store, actually a lot less. As Professor Warren has discovered, families are saving big bucks by skipping the T-bone steaks, buying their cereal in bulk, and opting for generic paper goods and canned vegetables. When the figures are looked at, those savings more than compensate for all the restaurant eating. So much so that today's family of four is actually spending 22% less on food at home and restaurant eating combined than its counterpart of a generation ago. Now, what about outfitting our homes? Well, Affluenza rails against appliances that were deemed luxuries as recently as 1970, but are now found in well over half of the U.S. homes and thought of by a majority of Americans as necessities, such as dishwashers, clothes, dryers, central heating, air conditioning, color and cable TV. Now we have these plasma TVs. But once again, even though these handy gadgets may have captured a new place in Americans' hearts, they aren't taking up much space in our wallet. Manufacturing costs are down and durability is up, according to Professor Warren. When the microwave oven, the dishwasher, and clothes dryer are combined with the refrigerator, washing machine, and stove, families are actually spending, get this, 44% less on major appliances today than they were a generation ago. Another hot topic is vacation homes. A financial columnist for Money Magazine explains how life has changed, saying that a generation ago, the dream vacation was a modest affair. Come summer, the family piled into his Ford country wagon and tooled off to Lake Wachimasaki for a couple of weeks. Now, the columnist stated, things have changed. The rented cabin on the lake gave way to a second home high on an ocean dune. But, frankly, the world he describes does not exist, at least not for the middle-class family. Despite a lot of rhetoric, summer homes remain the fairly exclusive privilege of the well-to-do. In 1973, 3.2% of families reported expenses associated with owning a vacation home. By 2000, the proportion had just inched up to about 4%. So that's not a good argument either. But certainly, we can't say that middle-class families never fritter away any money. A generation ago, big-screen televisions were a novelty reserved for the very rich, and DVDs and TiVos were meaningless strings of letters. So how much more do families now spend on home entertainment, premium channels included? Well, we actually do spend more. We spend 23% more. But when you do the numbers, it comes out to be $170 more annually. But what about computers? They certainly will add to our budget. Again, when Professor Warren did the numbers, it comes out to approximately another $300 to the annual family budget. But when you package it all, it looks a little different because the increase in the context of other spending isn't very much. The extra money spent on, for example, the cable, electronics, and computers is much more offset by family savings on major appliances and household furnishings from the past. And in the analysis, the same kind of balancing act holds true in other areas. For example, the average family spends more on airline travel than it did a generation ago, but it spends less on dry cleaning, more on telephone services, but less on tobacco, more on pets, but less on carpets. And these are all statistics that are factual. So when we add it all up, increases in one category are offset by decreases in another. In other words, when we put it all together, there seems to be about as much frivolous spending today as there was a generation ago. Yet the myth really remains rock solid. Middle-class families are rushing headlong into financial ruin because they are squandering too much money on the restaurants, on the designer clothes, on the trips. And Americans cling so tightly to this myth, not because it is supported by hard evidence, but because it's comforting as a way to explain some of the very bad news. If families are in trouble because they squander their money, then those of us who shop at stores like Costco, where you can buy in bulk, or cook our own pasta, we have nothing to worry about. We also conclude if families are to blame for their own failures, then the rest of us bear no responsibility for helping those who are in trouble. Their fault, their problem. In short, the experts advising the financial failures to basically simplify, stay away from Perrier, stay away from Rolex, follow sensible advice and credit card balances will vanish. Bankruptcy filings will disappear, and mortgage foreclosures will cease to plague America. We're going to discover that none of this is true, and we will continue next week in discovering where did the money go. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. You have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083. Or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.